Junior Vice President of the Institute, and I'm standing here this evening because Jeremy Gohmert, the President, is in Berlin at a meeting of the International Actuarial Association. Peter Tompkins, the Senior Vice President, who would normally officiate on such occasions, very kindly offered me the opportunity to do so instead, on the basis that the subject matter of tonight's discussion was more up my street than his, and I guess I'll know in a couple of hours whether I was wise to accept his kind offer or not. Copies of the minutes of the Ordinary General Meeting held on the 27th of October 2003 have been displayed on the Institute notice board and will be taken as read. May I sign the minutes as a correct record? Thank you. May I extend a particular welcome to our official guests this evening? Those are Paul Sharma, Head of Policy at the Financial Services Authority, Sarah Varney, Manager Insurance Technical Research Team at the Financial Services Authority, Alan Cook, Technical Director at the Accounting Standards Board, Simon Peerless, Project Director Insurance Matters at the Accounting Standards Board, Benedict McHugo, Head of Tax at the ABI, and Valerie Montan, financial attaché at the French Embassy. And I hope that the fact that we have a French lady diplomat present this evening means that we'll have a civilised discussion. I'd also like to welcome all personal guests of members and anyone else that I've forgotten to mention, and any guests are welcome to speak during the discussion. I now have a couple of presentations to make. I'm delighted to welcome one of our recently elected honorary fellows, the Right Honourable the Lord Hunter of the Wirral, MBE, to this meeting. David Hunt is Senior Partner of Beechcroft Wandsborough's solicitors. He specialises in insurance, advising the Association of British Insurers and many leading insurance companies. He's been a Member of Parliament for Wirral for 21 years. As a Member of the House of Lords, he represents the all-party parliamentary group on insurance and financial services. Lord Hunt is Chairman of the Steering Group, which founded the Association of Independent Financial Advisors and was its chairman until 2003. The actuarial profession is very pleased to have strengthened its links with such an influential figure in the world of insurance and financial services, and we're delighted that the Right Honourable the Lord Hunt of the Wirral has accepted our invitation to be an Honorary Fellow of the Institute. And I'd now like to ask David to step forward so that I can present him with his certificate.
First of all, may I say how grateful I am to the Institute for all the tremendous briefing you give my parliamentary colleagues and me over a number of years now in the all-party group and elsewhere. Secondly, may I just say how honoured and delighted I am to have become an honorary fellow. Rather surprised, still politicians are never supposed to be surprised, but can I say that I did feel that as a member of the House of Commons and then the House of Lords, I belonged to the most exclusive club that there was. Now, having become one of your honorary fellows, I'm in a new, very exclusive club, and I have to tell you, I treasure this one just a little bit more. Thank you.
Thank you.
right. Now, I'm also delighted to welcome Raki Gulrajani of PricewaterhouseCoopers to this meeting. Raki is the inaugural winner of the McKinsey Prize for Communications, awarded to the best performing student in Subject 201, the Communications Paper. The award of this prize has been made possible by McKinsey's offering to provide sponsorship to the profession, and in addition to providing the prize, McKinsey's will also sponsor other educational work undertaken by the profession. Now, Stephen Mendel of McKinsey's is here and would like to say a few words before I make the presentation. Stephen, the floor is yours.
Good afternoon. I, as you just heard, am Stephen Mendel, an associate partner in the London office of McKinsey & Company, and a qualified actuary of some years' standing. It is McKinsey's great pleasure to be the sponsor of Subject 201, the communications paper. But before the award, I'd be grateful if you would indulge me just a couple of minutes. In a recent survey, two-thirds of actuaries expressed the desire to pursue their careers to the highest level, and recognised that this may mean changing employer. Indeed, 82% of the respondents in the same survey acknowledged that it may not be an advantage to remain with the same employer to achieve this goal. Yet, at the last sessional meeting I attended some 13 months ago, entitled Creating the Right Conditions for the UK Life Market to Flourish, most of the evening was spent discussing the likely death of the actuarial profession on the basis that most actuaries worked in life offices. This can only be true if actuaries are unable to change their focus and unable to bring their skills to bear in other areas. I call this the big actuarial myth. Let's look at the evidence of what must be true for the myth to hold. Actuaries would have to be reclusive backroom operatives. In addition, they'd have to be to work in only narrow, highly focused specialised fields, and their skills would be totally and utterly useless outside their traditional roles. And hence, actuaries would stay in doing the same jobs that they had always been doing for, say, the last 50 years. Well, McKinsey does not believe that this is true. We employ a number of actuaries who are able to communicate well and show the huge value that they can add. But don't take our word for it. This is a small sample of companies far outside the life sector that employ actuaries who must be clearly able to explain and prove their added value as well. So, the message is clear for the profession to survive, regardless of what happens to the fragile life industry, and to be able to debunk the myth of the stereotypical actuary. Just get out there and communicate. One such person who would not appear to have any of these issues is the winner of last year's 201 prize, Raki. I now pass over to the Vice President, who will make the award.
Thank you, Steve. I would now like to ask Raki to step forward so that I can present her with her certificate and a cheque for £250. That's enough presentations then. Now to the papers for this evening. And the first paper is Realistic Liabilities and Risk Capital Margins for With-Profits Business, by David Dulloway and Stephen Needleman. David Dulloway, unfortunately, isn't here this evening. He's in the US, apparently. And so I'll now ask Peter Needleman to introduce the paper.
Thank you, Nick. The purpose of our paper was to prompt discussion around the recent developments in regulatory reporting for with-profit funds, in particular the use of a realistic basis for determining liabilities and risk-based solvency capital. I should start by saying that we are supportive of the move to realistic reporting and the realistic balance sheet. The approach is a sensible and internally consistent way of providing for the quite complex interactions between assets and liabilities and the guarantees and options within a with-profit fund. Having said this, we do have some concerns about the way that some of the concepts have been developed and the practicality of implementing them. There are many areas for discussion, and I've set out what we see as the most important on this slide. These include aspects of the theory behind the calculation of the realistic liabilities and the risk capital margin, and a number of practical issues regarding implementing this theory. Any change in approach will also have implications for the fair treatment of policyholders. Looking first at the calculation of realistic liabilities, CP195 sets out very clearly what it was intending to achieve: a value of the contractual benefits plus an additional value for the possible future discretionary benefits. This is not, however, what the proposals in CP195 go on to discuss. Rather, they implement an asset share-based valuation methodology. A comparison of the two approaches is set out on the next slide. What we've called the put option approach is consistent with starting from the asset share and adding on the value of the underlying guarantees, which is how CP195 has in practice been framed. The call option approach on the right starts from the value of the guarantees and then adds on the value of discretionary benefits, which represent the profits that with profits products promise, assuming that they emerge in practice. The asset share approach has served us well, particularly in times of plenty. However, in circumstances where solvency is less clear or may be threatened, it's of less relevance in the prudential regulation of a with-profits fund. In particular, it can give the impression that a with-profits policy is a type of unit-linked product that will pay out in all circumstances the greater of asset share or the sum assured plus bonuses. We believe that this understates the management discretion to quite a great degree. We would argue that the call option approach regulates asset shares to their proper place as one, albeit an important one, of many factors that drive bonus decisions. We would also argue that in current circumstances, where guaranteed benefits are often of a similar level to asset shares, that this approach highlights the true economics of a with-profit fund. Moving on to the risk capital margin, the approach set out in CP195 has an elegant logic. The RCM should, in theory, be sufficient to ensure that in the worst case, if a fund cannot meet its capital requirements, it will still have enough money to be able to hedge out its liabilities. We believe this is the rationalisation of the basis for the RCM, although the FSA have not actually said this explicitly. However, for this to work in practice, the risk capital margin must allow for the true costs of hedging in stressed circumstances. This requires allowing for any increase in options volatility that may follow a crash and the possibility that some assets may only be realised at fire sale prices. As currently presented, CP195 does not make such an allowance, bringing into question whether the approach would hold in practice. As importantly, it is not clear that management would actually move to a hedge position in such circumstances, nor that the FSA would actually force them to do so. Without such actions, the approach is less relevant, and perhaps a long-term run-off approach might be more suitable. We certainly believe that that should be the approach used for the individual capital assessment. Turning to some of the practical issues, the first of these concerns the calibration and model selection. Much has been said on this subject, but in our view, calibration is more important than the actual choice of model itself. We believe that calibration should be to implied volatilities for a market-consistent valuation. However, if we move to a runoff approach, for example, for the ICA, then perhaps historic volatilities may be more appropriate. More contentious is the choice of the risk-free rate. In theory, there should be a single risk-free yield curve. But in practice, the difference between possible close substitutes is too large to accept that there is not a bias in at least some of them. We favour starting from a swap curve, but we know others prefer gilts. We are sure that this debate will continue. A further question is whether a risk-free curve is even appropriate at all. Most hedging instruments are not quite risk-free, and the FSA has said that it does not want a no-failure regime. Should we therefore be assuming an interest rate that is consistent with an acceptably small level of risk rather than a completely risk-free rate? Next, we come to the question of modelling management actions. This slide sets out some of the approaches used in allowing for management actions. Few companies have yet developed the full-blown dynamic models required to fully allow for such actions, but for many this is the goal. However, does the greater realism that this may produce justify the extra expense? The really important actions will be those taken in extreme situations, i.e. when the risk capital margin is breached. This requires projecting the future level of solvency within each scenario at each point of time, and an approximate solution to this is unavoidable. Equally as important is the need to explore what the limits of management actions really are in these extreme circumstances. Recent actions by many funds suggest to us that these limits are more sweeping and these actions more extreme than might have been assumed in the past, especially when the fund faces true insolvency. Finally, one topic that we did not have time to discuss fully in the paper, but which merits attention, is the question of equity between policyholders. The move to a realistic reporting basis has already impacted bonus policy and investment strategy quite significantly, and we need to think about these actions from the policyholder's perspective. Because market-consistent liabilities are greater than best estimate cash flows, realistic reporting will have the effect of weighting bonus payments from currently retiring or maturing policyholders to future generations. Whether this is inequitable or simply reflects the relative risk between the different generations is open to question. What is clear is that without careful thought and management, this could lead to the development of a tontine, certainly in a closed fund. In conclusion, we support the move to realistic reporting, but do question some aspects of the fine print. It falls to the actuarial profession, as technical experts in this area, to highlight the flaws and propose workable solutions. We hope that the discussion tonight will help this process along. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Peter. And I'd now like to invite Ralph Franklin to summarise the paper by the With Profits Working Party of the Profession's 2005 accounting project, The Realistic Reporting of With Profits Business.
Thank you very much. It may seem strange that a working party on an accounting project is talking to you about regulatory liabilities and the realistic reporting in that context. However, having begun our work to come up with a sensible set of recommendations in the context of international accounting standards, it was thought by the profession that it would be useful if we turned our attention to the growing debate in terms of realistic reporting and statutory liabilities. The working party did so turn its attention and has looked at this from a point of view of first principles. We've gone back to ask the question, why are we going on this journey? Where is it taking us? Is it the right direction? We began by looking at the recent history of the journey and then moving on to the consideration of why it is that with-profits business is special, and what the characteristics are that mean it does need to be given special consideration. We've then reviewed possible methodologies. We began our work in the dark days before CP195. At that time, it was not clear that the route to be chosen by FSA was the one that would be adopted. We then considered possible approaches, not just to the valuation of the with-profits business, but to the wider aspects of financial regulation and how a realistic reporting framework might fit such approaches. Given that during our considerations, our deliberations, there were various events, including the publication of CP195, we thought it appropriate to look at how our deliberations fitted with those proposals, and we began to identify some of the practical implementation issues of a realistic reporting environment. We've come to some tentative conclusions, which I'm going to share with you, though not, you'll be pleased to hear, the full logic of how we got there. And we also highlighted a number of matters which are outstanding and which need to be addressed if this proposal is to be taken forward. Our approach, which is relevant to our conclusions, was that we did two basic sets of investigations. The first was a comparison of stochastic models. There are questions that have been raised about the applicability of this approach, some of which begin to doubt whether or not it's possible to obtain consistent results with different stochastic models. We asked six consultancies, to whom we're enormously grateful, if they'd provide us with the valuation of different options that are common in with-profits business. We represented these options by a range of simple derivative contracts, many of which are not commonly traded, some of which are commonly traded and represent a useful benchmark for their results. We removed discretion from the equation. Although discretion is important in with-profits business, we didn't actually want the six consultancies applying discretion in different ways and thought a more meaningful conclusion would be reached with no discretion policies. The work was undertaken by individual consultancies. We say with limited guidance, we basically set them the problem of valuing these options to see what they'd come up with. And the conclusion of those results we'll get onto later. But we also took one single model out of the six and used that model to compare the impact of differing levels of discretion. We varied the level and the manner of the application of that discretion and also looked both at company discretion and different behavioural characteristics of policyholders in different economic scenarios. From these investigations, and from a number of other investigations we carried out, we reached the conclusions that a move to realistic reporting should be an improvement, indeed a considerable improvement, over where we are now. It will allow us to allow properly for embedded options and guarantees in with-profits contracts. It allows directly for management discretion, and that improves the quality of that recognition. It's consistent with capital treatment in the rest of in other financial markets. And as a solvency measurement tool, it should lead to capital requirements which provide appropriate protection to policyholders under a wider range of market conditions than current measurement tools. And again, it's consistent with capital allocation in wider financial markets. Most importantly, though, we believe that these approaches can, if used properly, avoid forced actions which are not really necessary, nor in the best interests of the fund, and therefore in the best interests of policyholders. But, and I'm afraid there's almost always a but, we did find that the results and the year-on-year change in results are very dependent on the choice of model. Specifically, as identified by Peter and David in their work, it's dependent on the calibration of the model and the choice of stocks. But that doesn't explain away all of the model dependency. Also, dependent on the extent of management discretion modelled. And as we've seen in recent years, extreme situations can see management go to the extreme of the discretion they have available to them. Also importantly, we've noticed that in modelling some of these guarantees, modelling approximations are often necessary, and the impact of these approximations is uncertain. The uncertainty is similar to that around the choice of model, but perhaps a little bit less predictable. And in particular, the approach of using closed form solutions, which is a common remedy for the difficulties of stochastic modelling, can lead to significant errors when applied to management decision processes. These four points and more suggest that market consistency of itself may not be sufficient to ensure a consistency between the values generated over time by a single company or between companies in their attempt to realistically report their with-profits business. When it comes to resilience and stress testing, we have the additional issues around choice of right or appropriate assumptions for option pricing of volatilities in resilience scenarios. This is not a trivial problem. If the market moves so that asset values move or yields move, it's very likely that volatilities will move too. Further, we need to consider what are the right resilience scenarios. The working party shared with Peter and David a concern that presenting the results in terms of an asset share plus a put may be significantly less helpful at critical times than showing it as a value of the guaranteed benefits plus some sort of call option. But where next? A sentence I lift directly from the paper. This is not the first paper to be written on the valuation of with-profits business, nor is it likely to be the last. And we hope that it will prove helpful in moving the debate forward. But specifically, we believe that further work is needed to sort out what precisely is meant, what we need to do, what we believe is right in the area of stress testing or resilience or risk capital determination. We need to help actuaries and others understand what exactly the dynamics are of the new regime. It's quite interesting that 18 years after resilience testing was first introduced, we still find the need to make short-term fixes because something that wasn't quite understood in 1985 has come and hit us unexpectedly in 2003. That change was far less radical than the move to realistic reporting. We can't wait 18 years to understand fully the dynamics of a realistic reporting environment. We believe we need to identify the extent to which consistency over time and between companies, A, is desirable, and assuming that it is, establish how we can achieve that desirable consistency. And then we need to understand how we can best manage with-profits life assurance, given that most companies who write this type of business have only a finite amount of capital. But in the new regulatory world, new asset strategies, new bonus strategies potentially become imperative, bearing in mind that we have only a short period before we need to commit many of those practices to print in PPFMs. We have very little time in which to ensure that the management practices we wish to adopt can be set out in a way that treats policyholders fairly. They were the issues that we identified as requiring further work. Even in the last week, others have occurred to us besides. But I'm sure few would dispute that if we're to implement this effectively within the timescales envisaged within CP195, there is a lot more work, and even the scope of that work needs to be established urgently. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much, Ralph. I'd now like to ask Mike Kipling to summarise the profession's response to CP195, and Benedict, there's a seat for you at the front here, if you'd like to come up and take it.
The Supervision Committee of the Life Board is very grateful to Peter Joshi for preparing a first draft of the profession's response to CP195, and to members of the Life Board, especially to Peter Wright, for their additional input. CP195 itself is 329 pages long. It has been impossible to examine in detail every aspect of all the proposed rules and guidance, although we have sought to draw attention to as many of the more detailed drafting points as we have identified. Tonight, I suggest most additional input relates to the bigger issues. However, please email Maria Singleton at Staple Inn with any drafting points which you think we should include in our submission, which I'm afraid will have to be submitted by the end of this week. In the next few minutes, I'll just go through a few of those bigger issues. As we say in paragraph one, we are supportive of a Basel three-pillar approach, a published first pillar, which provides the relatively formulaic minimum published capital, a second pillar shared only with the regulator, which embraces a wider selection of risks in a more individual way, and a third pillar of sufficient disclosure to enable rating agencies to carry out a reliable and consistent assessment across the industry. Our main concern, though, is that necessity, that mother of invention, has given birth somewhat prematurely to a less than fully developed child. This is due to the unfortunate requirement to have the EU life directives and historic practice as birthing partners. We consider that the market-consistent liabilities, taking policyholders' reasonable expectations into account, coupled with an appropriate capital margin, is the best way to meet Pillar 1 requirements for all types of life insurance. An approach which started from this premise and so made Peak 2 of Pillar 1, be careful here not to confuse pillars and peaks, making Peak 2 of Pillar 1 the foundation for Form 9, for Forms 51 to 52, and for the abstract of the Actuary's Report, will be much preferable. Compare that is with the CP195 proposal of as little change as possible, which gives rise to several issues, including inconsistencies of treatment of non-profit business, depending whether it is written in a with-profits fund or not, excessive length of valuation abstracts, as the main disclosure is still largely on the irrelevant Peak 1 basis, with what is billed as supplementary disclosure being the important one, the highly confusing and unnecessary concept of with-profits insurance capital component instead of an ab initio realistic Form 9 with, far more rarely, a Peak 1 supplement. Disclosure of the breakdown of realistic balance sheets not necessarily consistent with Form 5152 format, and some residual superequivalence to EU minima, which may lead to the difficulties in managing situations of similar heights of the Twin Peaks. We recognise that the current approach has been very valuable as an interim measure in the turbulent investment markets for the last 2 years. However, we think that with just a little more effort on behalf of the rulemakers and indeed the industry and the profession, something rather better and possibly more anticipatory of Solvency II can be implemented next year. In paragraphs 15 to 20, we set out some concerns we have with the risk capital margin. These include that it does not make allowance for several risks which might be material for some insurers, including annuitant longevity and changes in implied volatilities. It is difficult to see how there can be market confidence in a published solvency measure if there is no margin for some major generic risk exposures. We are concerned that some elements of the proposed stress tests perpetuate approaches shown to be inadequate, the gilt yield floor and equity falls being a prime example. We refer FSA to the work of our recent resilience working party for some alternative approaches. Approved securities should be treated separately from corporate debt when it comes to credit risk stress tests. We hope that FSA will allow a wide enough brief to the actuarial firm it intends to employ to advise on the eventual formulation of the risk capital margin to enable these types of issues to be addressed. The profession would also like to be involved in this process at a stage before minds become too made up. Both Pillar 1 and Pillar 2 will require the use of stochastic models. And from the With Profits Working Party paper, we can see that widely different results can be obtained depending on the model and in particular its calibration. I think we are at one with the FSA and with much of the industry in wishing that guidance can be provided. The Life Board will consider later this week the proposal made by the Stochastic Accreditation Working Party at last week's faculty sessional meeting to constitute a further working party to prepare guidance on the use of models. I expect the proposal to be endorsed and for the profession to have such guidance ready for consultation in spring next year. This is not to say that we will be able to come up with all the solutions, and we draw attention in our reply to CP 195 question 12, which is on page 11 of my printout, but may well be different than other people's, to the difficulties of attaching credible probabilities to extremal events to arrive at, for example, 99.5% certainties. Turning to Pillar 2, we agree that its objective should be to ensure that there is, as the paper says, to ensure that there is no significant risk that liabilities, including PRE, cannot be met when due. We suggest that this requires a runoff approach, and we refer to work done by the actuarial profession in other countries where a tail VAR approach to risk capital is becoming accepted as standard. We hope that the guidance which we are likely to prepare, which will be subject to due process consultation, will seek to address these matters too. Stochastic models will, quite rightly, take into account future management actions in line with PPFM. However, we highlight in our comments on the proposed PRU 1.2.37, again page 19 in my printout, that market capacity and liquidity needs to be a key consideration. What a small company can assume it will do and what a large company can assume are likely to be very different things. In paragraphs 33 to 35 of our draft response, we comment on the certification requirements. We welcome the role of the reviewing actuary. Whilst we hope that the auditing industry can see its way to provide the degree of assurance required at reasonable cost, we suggest an alternative which seems to us to achieve the FSA's objective just as well, if not actually better. We also confirm that, in line with the Corley Committee recommendations, we intend to bring in mandatory peer review for regulatory actuarial roles not required by FSA to have independent actuarial oversight, in particular in the carrying out of individual capital assessments. Finally, we draw attention to a so far neglected area of PRU, the definition of the amount of surplus transferable out of the Life Fund. I look forward to hearing your comments on our draft and on tonight's other two papers.
Thank you very much, Mike. David, your turn has come. I'll now ask David Murray to open the discussion.
Well, good evening, everyone. It's great to see the hall so full. We're actually overflowing tonight. I must take issue with the acting chairman for omitting to welcome a special group of people. So may I extend a very special welcome to any Australians in the audience. There are 250 people longing to stand next to you in the bar afterwards. The opener, by tradition, is one of the younger members of the profession, so it's very flattering to be standing here categorised in that way. I actually opened a meeting of the Institute about 4 years ago. That was on the subject of closed with-profit funds and how to manage them. That's proved very useful because I'm now the appointed actuary at Equitable Life. Now, I believe that this paper will be useful to us all. This is clearly a vital topic, and the timing of the paper is most opportune. So thank you to David and to Peter for their efforts in preparing it. And also, I think, to David Hare and his team for paving much of the way. To stimulate the discussion tonight, I'd like to concentrate on four themes. Firstly, the Twin Peaks approach. Secondly, the use of asset shares. Thirdly, choice and calibration of a model. And finally, some brief comments on the risk capital margin and modelling of management actions. So firstly, the Twin Peaks approach. Well, let me also say that I agree with the thrust of what FSA is doing. I think it's really good. And we've heard tonight that the authors agree. I'm not going to discuss the pros and cons of the call and the put option approach, because I think the bottom line is the same. But I do agree with the author's comments in paragraph 243 and 276 that it would be helpful to show separately the contractual benefits within the realistic peak. The complexity of the Twin Peaks presentation is mentioned in several places in the paper. But I wonder if the problem actually goes beyond presentation. I dislike the idea of choosing the higher of two completely different calculations for solvency reporting. Aren't we confusing two completely different questions? One is about solvency, it's about the ability to continue in business and meet your guarantees. The second, to me, seems to be about capital adequacy and the way that management manages the business. So if I can be contentious, wouldn't it be better to have one test that's based on contractual benefits? Pass that and you can continue in business. Then a completely separate test, the realistic test, based around the realistic balance sheet and a margin. And that would test whether a firm's capital resources were sufficient with regard to its bonus policy, its investment mix, its strategy on new business, to continue down its route. Fail that, and the company would have to seek more capital or change its investment mix, for example. I feel these are different questions, different hurdles, and I'm concerned that by linking them so closely, we're going to end up sending confusing messages to our managements and boards. FSA is asking all the right questions and I think asking for the right information, but maybe we should be presenting it much more separately. I think the ideas in the paper are one step down that road. Secondly, let me turn to asset shares. Paragraph 2.5.4 points out the danger of over-reliance on asset share information. It's the building block for the whole of the new balance sheet approach. But Peter's paper points out how rough and ready some of our bonus scales are. We have one terminal bonus scale applying to many contract types. We have asset share data for specimen policies only. Is that really good enough? Are we being complacent? It seemed to me all right at the time, my lord. I guess we all know that calculating historic asset shares from incomplete data and with the systems we have to work with is very difficult. But maybe paragraph 261 points at the way ahead to actually look forward and concentrate more on what future payments we're going to make to policyholders and perhaps forget some of how we got to where we got to with asset shares. Maybe that's just two different ways of looking at the same problem. Or do you think it really is a different way of cracking the problem? Your views, please. I found the sections on choice of asset model and calibration particularly interesting, and a really valuable checklist for us all on the points to consider in reviewing an asset model and a basis. We often tend to shy away from some of these difficult areas, but it's too important to shy away from. Section 3.4 put forward some very strong arguments for calibrating to swap rates rather than gilt rates. But there are also very strong arguments for the opposite approach. The matter was beautifully summarised in the first line of 3.4.4. Use of swap rates typically gives a risk-free rate of the order of 20 to 30 basis points above gilts. A risk-free rate of the order of 20 to 30 basis points above gilts. That's very clearly put, but to my way of thinking, that's all rather odd. How can there be a risk-free rate 20 to 30 basis points above gilts? I'm left a bit confused and worried, because these aren't esoteric matters. They can make a very big difference to the results. I don't think my personal opinion matters a jot, but we do need to have a view on this important matter as a profession, and when we then need to issue some appropriate guidance. Peter and David may well be right. Maybe there should be a margin over gilts, but we really need the debate, and I hope it can start tonight. The paper points out some other important areas where the choice of assumptions makes a huge difference. I don't feel particularly well qualified to recommend the equity volatility assumption to my board. How about you? But someone has to do it. Are these matters best left to old-fashioned actuarial judgment? Or should there be rigid rules? Or is there a viable middle course? I'd like the profession to help individual actuaries to make good recommendations to their boards. I'd really like some good guidance on that. Finally, sections 4 and 5, the risk capital margin and management actions. I really like the discussion around page 26 on the different types of stress test and some of the tests that are omitted. The paper notes that the extra capital from each of the tests is added together, and I agree with the author's view that that's somewhat unrealistic. I understand that internal capital assessments will allow some credit to be taken for non-correlation of risks, so why not when we calculate the RCM too? I suspect most of us would agree with the thrust of Section 5 on modelling the management actions. But let me raise just one thought. It can sometimes be tempting for us to model the actions which reduce the capital requirements. The investment rule set out in 5.4.11, for example, does just that, and I found it ingenious. But it's not enough for actuaries merely to think up ingenious algorithms that reduce the capital requirements. It will be great if we can devise them, show them to our management teams that they're practical propositions that really work, and influence our firms to adopt them. If that's what we're about, then I think we have a genuine role as experts of risk management and in helping management to manage their capital in the optimum manner. Is that the way ahead for life actuaries? What do you think? Peter, David, thank you very much for your paper. It's made me challenge some of my own preconceptions, and I've learned a lot through reading it. I think the subject matter is so vital to the future of the profession, it's worthy of full debate. I hope that fellow members and guests will participate fully in that debate tonight. Thank you.
Right, now the time has come to open the discussion to the floor. I have 11 names of people who have already indicated that they wish to speak. Excluding those 11 people, how many others would like an opportunity to speak if there's time? One. OK. Okay. Well, hopefully we will have a chance for everyone who wants to speak then. The suggestion is that contributors limit their comments to 3 minutes, please. Please don't let the fact that the meeting's being recorded deter you from contributing. All speakers will be given the opportunity to see their comments before they get published in the British Actuarial Journal. If time doesn't allow you to make your full contribution, then you can always add the rest as a written contribution and it will be published. Roving microphones are available if you'd like to speak from the body of the hall. Alternatively, come to the lectern at the front of the hall. And please state your name clearly before speaking. Right, I'd like then to start with the list that I've got, and I'd like first of all to call Andrew Sanders, followed by David Wilkie.
Junior Vice President, ladies and gentlemen, this paper is a very useful, well, these two papers are a very, very useful contributions to a topic that, due to its rapid evolution, has received less discussion than its importance merits, and I too thank the authors. There is widespread acceptance that the realistic balance sheet approach represents a step forward. However, whereas we have a good understanding of the requirements and the strengths and deficiencies of the old regime, we do not yet have the same level of understanding for the new approach. There is clearly some way to go before we have a robust system and greater uniformity. But I wouldn't go so far as the author's conclusion in 6.5 that it will be some years before realistic liabilities will be produced to audit standard. If we really believe that, then I don't see how we could support implementation in 2004. Apart from the technical issues, which, though complex, are capable of resolution, there are philosophical issues about how much capital should be held and in what form. With-profits business is subject to discretion, and different parts of the realistic balance sheet are subject to difference of that discretion. Asset shares may be seen as a reasonably objective representation of a potential liability. Nonetheless, in extremis, losses that might otherwise be charged to the estate can be charged to asset shares, and past discretionary enhancements to asset shares might also be clawed back. This makes identification of what should be treated as a liability, what should be regarded as available for the risk capital margin, and what should be regarded as free capital as subject to judgment. Differences in treatment may produce lack of comparability of realistic surplus between companies. Hence, it is important not only that the underlying issues are clarified, but also that the modelling is then sufficiently realistic to reflect what is actually likely to happen in practice, particularly in respect of management actions. The clarification of the operation of with-profits business via developments such as the PPFM and the realistic balance sheet is desirable for a whole range of reasons, not least in helping to clarify this issue of how much capital should be set aside to back potential obligations to policyholders. However, it's quite possible that these developments, together with the trend towards market-consistent approaches to valuation, may lead companies to decide to run their with-profit business at a lower level of risk than originally intended. The consequence may be a lower level of potential reward to policyholders. Companies will need to be careful in this respect. Too cautious an asset allocation may provoke issues in relation to policyholders' contractual rights and expectations, with potential for adverse publicity and mis-selling claims. My final point is on the appropriate treatment of subordinated debt, as discussed in 4.4. This is allowable capital to meet the required minimum margin under current FSA and EU rules. It is deductible as a liability in the realistic balance sheet, although the ultimate treatment is not entirely clear in CP195. It seems to be wholly reasonable to treat it as available capital that can be used to meet liabilities attributable to the risk capital margin, subject to appropriate limitation as required under EU rules. it would seem anomalous not to do so. So I endorse the author's suggestion along these lines in 4.4.5. It also seems reasonable that future shareholder transfers are allowed to be available for the risk capital margin as suggested in 4.4.4.
And then Paul Seymour.
Thank you, Mr. President. For the record, my name is David Wilkie. I'd prepared quite a lot of comments about simulation models, but I shall cut down considerably and submit most of my comments as a written contribution. However, I'm now convinced that the FSA, accompanied by many of the actuarial profession, are setting out down a blind alley which in due course will be found to be a dead end and they have to reverse. It's much better to consider things carefully now to set out in the right direction, even if this means some delay in introducing the new system. And the problem is that the FSA has chosen to go for a complicated model for valuing options embedded in life policies, preferring a simulation model for that, and also a relatively simple scenario testing model for evaluating risk-based capital, which I would prefer to call contingency reserves. I think the reverse would be right, a simple option pricing model that gives, if possible, closed-form analytical answers, and a real-world stochastic simulation model, which can be as complicated as you like, for calculating contingency reserves. The right way to calculate the amount that might be needed for these contingency reserves was described by my co-authors and myself in our paper on guaranteed annuity options presented here last month. So you could have a look at that. One needs a real-world model that replicates the real world as complexity with the complexity you like. You then simulate what might happen to the portfolio, making appropriate assumptions. And one of the things you can do is to hedge embedded options, and for this you need to calculate the hedging quantities. The net hedging value is in some sense the theoretical value of the option. That's not so relevant as knowing the hedging quantities and embedding those into the real world model, calculate the distribution of hedging error, where you can get a best estimate, which is the average, a fair value, which includes the cost of contingency reserves, a rent for the contingency reserves, it were, and a prudent value, and that includes the contingency reserves. And the theoretical world where of option pricing allows for the hedging error being nil, but the theoretical option pricing world is as unrealistic as the traditional actuarial model where interest rates are always 4% and we always know the mortality rates. So we need practical hedging models that are sufficiently simple that we can use within the more complicated simulations of the real world. Market consistency, I don't think, is necessary, though it is relevant. We don't seek market consistency when we're valuing an annuity portfolio in respect to the mortality rates. Otherwise, we'd just be following the mortality rates of the leading office. With traded options, we don't know the volatilities. And we never know the volatilities if they're changing with time, just as if mortality rates are changing with time. We never know what the mortality rates actually are. All we've got in both cases are estimates. Interest rates are different because if you invest, say, £1 million now in gilt strips, you can get approximately £2 million from the British government on the 7th of December 2017 with certainty. Swaps are an alternative. I don't like them so much because they're not really an investment. You've actually got to invest your money somewhere else in order to earn the money to pay the other side of the floating rate side of the swap curve. So I describe quite a lot of aspects in this as to how complicated the real-world model should be, and the real-world model should include the management actions that people have been talking about, and you shouldn't try to put those into the hedging model. The FSA should be concerned about the real-world model used by a life office. Indeed, it might be correct for the FSA to specify much of that model completely, though it would be difficult to allow for every feature required by every life office. The way things that have developed in Canada, with the supervisor defining criteria that the life office models must meet, but allowing offices to use any model that meets those criteria, may be the way forward. Now, what I've said fits well with the author's comments in section 2. Value the guaranteed benefits, add the cost of embedded options, and add contingency reserves. If bonuses are to be based on asset shares in some way, then that's where asset shares come in, not at the start. And finally, I can see nothing in the valuation principles in the Third Life Directive that would prevent a realistic valuation on the author's lines rather than the FSAs being introduced. And since I wrote most of the first draft of those valuation principles myself, I do know what the original authors thought they meant. I could go into more detail, but I'd be interested to know why the FSA believes that their realistic peak, perhaps modified as the authors suggest, would not meet those valuation principles. Thank you.
Paul Seymour and then Andrew Smith.
Mr. Vice President, as you say, my name is Paul Seymour. You will also know, I think, from your personal experience of me, that I'm rather a long way from the technical detail on this sort of a subject, so you might wonder what I'm doing standing here speaking on it. Once upon a time, however, I was something, or at least I had, I think, something more of a reputation as a bright young thing in the unit-linked world in the 60s and the 70s. And it's based on those experiences that I thought I might comment on just one issue, and that is the issue of allowing or not allowing for future management actions in assessing the realistic capital requirement. Some of you will be aware that in many of the meetings over the past 3 or 4 years, I have already forcibly expressed my view that transparency and the concept of with profits will actually prove impossible for management to reconcile. And I'm more than happy at my time of life, I have to say, not to have to attempt it myself. But what do I see as the unit-linked lessons from the past? Back then, the debate was rather simpler about the feasibility of granting maturity guarantees. And there were those who argued that by using a flexible managed fund in which management would have the power, for example, to switch 100% into bonds, we called them gilts then, it was possible to offer such guarantees. Their argument was that when the equity market reached a certain low point, the guarantee could be matched by a move into fixed interest. I contended then, and I still contend, that that idea is completely wrong. First, will the decision rule to be used by management be fixed now? How will it work when the time comes? And there are many, many echoes in tonight's paper of this concern. And for the record, I have written them all down. I won't read them out to you. Two quotes, however, I would particularly emphasize. First, management actions that might be taken are generally difficult to visualize in advance. Quote, unquote. That one in 564. And later, it remains to be seen how much credence the FSA will give to plans for the future. And the authors hint at their position in 5.7.1. One possibility is not to anticipate future management actions. Unfortunately, to my mind, they don't follow this through into their conclusions in 6.4. Preferring the more woolly, and I quote, no doubt the PPFM will continue to change and be refined over a number of years as management technique and policyholder expectations develop over time. As I said earlier, I read this as code for the simple point that we are attempting the impossible. Before I go, just let me add the second lesson from unit-linked debate. For a closed managed fund, or one with specific end dates, it is at least possible to imagine a decision rule for management action that would match guarantees. For an open fund, even that theory breaks down. How can management cover a guarantee falling due in, say, 5 years, and at the same time accept new entrants with an expectation of equity backing over 25 years or more? Please let us not fool ourselves over such important customer issues. With our, or, Mr. Vice President, I would have said our President's particular emphasis on looking at the world through the customer's end of the telescope, we do need to be totally confident in our own management methodology. And for myself, I am not.
Andrew, and then Colin Wilson.
Mr. President, ladies and gentlemen, good evening. I'd like to comment on three areas in relation to realistic liability valuation: the choice of the risk-free rate, the calibration of asset models, and analytical valuation of liabilities. I'm going to focus on the Dalloway and Needleman paper. Section 3.4 advocates the use of a swap curve to discount fixed liabilities. If you really believed that the swap curve represented the risk-free rate, I suggest you should also take a haircut to the market value of any gilts you happen to hold, because their guaranteed returns are lower than your assumed risk-free rate. So do I see anybody doing this? No, I don't. Instead, everybody seems quite happy to take credit for gilt yields implicitly in their, as their risk-free rate to discount the receivables from their gilt-edged securities. In contrast, as David Wilkie has already pointed out, an interest rate swap is a derivative on LIBOR, which is itself a rate for risky interbank deposits. The paper mentions several attractive features of swap rates, including the liquidity of the swap market and the fact that banks use swaps in some of their derivative pricing models. These attributes are shared by many other market prices. For example, the yen to dollar exchange rate is traded in a liquid market and is also used for pricing many derivatives. Swap rates have one more feature in common with the yen-dollar exchange rate. Neither of them is a risk-free return on sterling investments. A balance sheet with different risk-free rates applied to assets and liabilities is internally consistent and lacks robustness. In private, many experts would question the use of swap rates in this context, but would also concede the commercial futility of trying to impose intellectual purity on clients anxious to minimise their liabilities and maximise their assets, unless this were backed up by robust guidance from this institute or from the FSA. Calibrating asset models to market prices can be tricky, and there are many aspects to be considered. These include the shape of the implied volatility curve for at-the-money swaptions, which 3.4.10 discusses. Let us not forget more basic constraints. For example, we should be wary of models permitting negative interest rates or negative credit spreads. I think we should question models which assume 100% correlation between interest rates of different terms. An ideal model would provide a risk explanation for the spread between gilts and swaps. It is desirable to fit not only options at the money, but also in and out of the money option prices. Contrary to the suggestion in 3.4.8, I have found that the shape of equity implied volatilities, the so-called smile effect, is an important factor in the stated cost of with-profit guarantees. This effect, incidentally, is not difficult to model. Now, suppose you had an asset model which calibrates well to at-the-money swaptions, but poorly to swap credit spreads, fails to capture the smile effect, and sometimes produces negative interest rates. This model might be easy to type in from a textbook, but is the tail wagging the dog? We should be building models to reflect what is important for insurance liabilities, and not defining importance by chance features of textbook models. Section 3.4.12 suggests that in the absence of market-implied volatility, a historical volatility applies instead. So if my fund is a FTSE 100 tracker, I use a market-implied volatility of, say, 25% to value the guarantees. But if I throw in an additional property investment, there are no options on the whole portfolio. Should I then use a historic portfolio volatility of, say, 20%? As in many areas, the paper errs in the direction of producing lower liabilities. This is human nature. After all, what insurer ever hired consultants to increase their stated liabilities? We should look to the experience of our pensions colleagues over the last decade and then reconsider whether the blunt tool of prescriptive guidance could head off a corrosive competition in laxity. I will close with a comment on section 5.3. The authors suggest, and Peter repeated this in his slides, that an office can either use closed form solutions or allow for dynamic management actions, but not both. In fact, there are many ways to model dynamic actions, several of which can lead to closed form solutions, albeit with more terms than the Black and Scholes formula. With these solutions, there is no Monte Carlo simulation error, and error from model point grouping is reduced because faster run times permit you to use more model points in the first place. Let us not condemn all offices to a Monte Carlo treadmill if simpler approaches can be just as accurate. Thank you.
Colin and then Richard Walker.
Always a hard act to follow, ladies and gentlemen, but I will try. Both tonight's paper, by which I mean the Dalloway and Needleman paper, and the profession's draft response to CMB 195, I believe do an admirable job of assessing how companies can seek to implement the proposed new regulations, and at the same time pointing out where some refinement of the proposals is required. However, I'd like to take a step back to consider some of the possible wider implications of adopting these proposals. I should start by saying that I think the realistic valuation techniques now being developed by the actuarial profession are enormously helpful in aiding understanding of some of the risks being run by insurance companies and potential cross-subsidies between different groups of policyholders. Where there is a sufficiently deep and liquid market for assets with the same characteristics as our liabilities, so-called market-consistent valuation is undoubtedly the right approach. But this begs the question as to what constitutes a sufficiently deep and liquid market. I believe the proposals in CP 195 and tonight's paper underestimate the difficulties here. For example, in 3.4.8, there is reference to implied equity volatilities out to 10 years, and in 3.4.11, to swaptions with option maturities up to 40 years. It is true that market quotes can generally be obtained for such instruments, but the market is not liquid and bid offer spreads are high. I simply do not believe that these market prices can be relied on for valuing long-term insurance liabilities. Insurance companies and pension funds are natural providers of long-term capital, but there are few others prepared to write long-dated options, even if they think the price is attractive. The resulting imbalance between natural supply and demand can lead to distorted prices relative to true expectations. It can therefore be unhelpful to use these prices to represent realistic liabilities. Even more so is it inappropriate to measure capital requirements by applying a short-term stress test to this value. These issues are ones which very much concern those with an interest in maintaining the stability of the world's financial markets. For example, to quote from the IMF's September 2003 Global Financial Stability Report, an important continuing policy question is how to avoid creating circumstances where, in a crisis, participants' attempts to control their own risk by selling into falling markets make the overall system unstable in new ways. One area where difficult judgments need to be made is fair value accounting, and particularly how it relates to longer-term investments by financial institutions such as insurance firms and pension funds. It is important to give the public a transparent measure of institutions' financial situations in existing market conditions, while avoiding excessive focus on the balance sheet impact from short-term volatility. Or again, to quote from an earlier IMF speech in June 2003, it is probably relatively uncontroversial that market values of assets and liabilities at any one moment may not indicate the long-term health of a firm if they represent transitory short-term volatility or if market prices are in some way distorted. Unnecessary noise arising from temporary fluctuations could add to financial stability risks in the system. My own experience with financial markets leads me to believe that short-term supply and demand factors can have a profound effect on market prices. The proposals in CP195 will put pressure on companies to hedge their liabilities as much as possible with matching assets in order to avoid the excess volatility that these short-term factors can generate. But as others have already said, this may not be in the best interests of policyholders, nor help the FSA to meet its overall objectives. And as the professions draft response recognises this and goes on to say, if we assume fully matched positions cannot or will not be adopted, it would be appropriate to consider the financial resources required to fund a runoff of the liabilities. This approach implies a real-world model to project possible outcomes and not simply a market-consistent model to estimate how much the financial markets would charge today to hedge the liabilities. Of course, there may be even more questions over an appropriate calibration of the real-world model. Nevertheless, it is a philosophical distinction of fundamental importance, which I believe helps to address some of the stability issues that I've raised. So where does this leave us? I believe it implies that the focus of capital adequacy should be on Pillar 2, where companies can make appropriate allowance for the long-term nature of their business. For Pillar 1, the realistic reserves, and especially the risk capital margin, should be allowed to depart from pure market consistency, where it is believed that the market does not reflect a reasonable assessment of long-term value or is suffering temporary distortion. The FSA should announce its intention of relaxing the rules whenever such situations arise, as indeed it has recently done for the resilience test, in order to reduce the pressures on companies which help lead to such distortions in the first place. We should recognise that without such an approach on the part of the FSA, the current proposals will increase the frequency of occasions when such a relaxation would be required in practice.
Thank you very much. Richard Waller and then Higgs.
Good evening, everybody. My name is Richard Waller. My comments this evening are directed at the Dalloway and Needleman paper. I would like to thank the authors for a well-written paper that I believe is a useful contribution to the ongoing debate within the profession. In view of the short time allowed this evening, I shall limit my comments to modelling issues. The authors suggest at the end of section 5 that the dynamic simulation approach is too complicated and propose firms adopt a non-dynamic approach instead. This seems an odd proposal and serves to defeat the purpose of establishing models capable of accurately reflecting the future experience of the fund and management's ability to react to prevailing conditions. The inevitable consequence of the non-dynamic approach suggested will be excessive Pillar 1 capital requirements, published results that conceal the true picture of firms' financial positions, and hence further statements from firms intended to give reassurance that things really aren't as bad as it appears. This will not be much of a step forward from where we are now, either for the industry or the profession. I therefore strongly disagree with the suggestion that we shouldn't try to build accurate and reliable models because of their complexity. I believe the additional complexity is manageable and the benefits of more accurate and lower capital requirements merit that additional effort. Firms should be encouraged to develop dynamic simulation approaches, and I would concur with the comments in paragraph 5.3.2 that some firms are there already and many others are moving in that direction. There are clear benefits to firms of having a realistic, dynamic model of their business outside of meeting regulatory requirements. For example, in terms of investigating fairness issues and shaping management policy going forwards, which are not so readily available from less complex approaches. This aspect of what model to build or which valuation approach to adopt is not covered in the paper, but should nevertheless be borne in mind when developing a model. I would also question the comments earlier in the paper, in paragraphs 3.2.4 and 3.2.5, where the authors promote closed-form solutions over stochastic methods as being sufficiently accurate. Whereas this may be true in some situations, there are a number of limitations with closed-form solutions, such as the inability to accurately allow for regular premiums, dynamic bonuses, and dynamic asset allocation. Now, we've heard from Andrew already this evening that some of these limitations could be overcome, but even the more advanced analytical approaches still fail when it comes to allowing for the past dependency of guarantees, the fact that they are based on the complex underlying asset portfolio, or recharging of those guarantee costs back to asset shares. In our experience of market-consistent stochastic modelling, we have found that much higher capital requirements can result if these features are not reflected dynamically in the model. We have also found that simplistic allowances for such features can materially misstate the cost, and it is questionable, therefore, what credit should be allowed in a regulated context for management action when that aspect of the model is not sufficiently robust. Thus, I would exercise caution against reaching the conclusion that simpler or analytical approaches are sufficient. However, I do agree with the final sentence of 3.2.5 that analytical approaches can be useful, for example, in terms of benchmarking simulation methods or supporting decision rules that would otherwise require projections within projections. Before I move on to discuss market-consistent asset models, I have one other comment about the overall valuation approach, which is the anomalous treatment of non-profit business written inside with-profit funds. I believe there's widespread agreement within the profession that this anomaly should be removed and the valuation of non-profit business moved to a market-consistent basis. This would, however, not overcome the real commercial disadvantage potentially faced by firms where the non-profit business is written outside of with-profit funds, as the FSA proposals currently stand, and I would encourage FSA to reconsider this aspect of its proposals, in particular, to restore the level playing field. Turning now to asset models and my final point. In paragraphs 3.3.4 to 3.3.6, the authors identify the issues around market-consistent asset models and their calibrations. Like the authors, the conclusion being reached by others within the profession is that it's the calibration and not the choice of model that matters. But this does not mean that the choice of model is of no consequence. Some asset models can calibrate to more financial instruments than others, and the degree of coverage of the whole market is critical when it comes to achieving a sufficiently close market-consistent value for assets relevant to the liabilities in question but outside of the model's calibration set. Another important factor here is the efficiency of the model in terms of achieving a market-consistent result for the fewest simulations, and we all know the impact of this from our runtimes. Deflator models have potential advantages through the extra freedom created by the risk premia assumptions made, and the choice of process used to create the underlying randomness within the simulations is also potentially significant. I think in view of the time, I'll leave my remaining comment as a written contribution.
Thank you very much. The average time taken by the first six speakers is about 5 minutes. Can the remaining speakers please try and keep their remarks short? Otherwise, we won't get everyone in. Icky and then Seamus Creed.
Okay, Mr. Junior Vice President, ladies and gentlemen. We have three good papers to consider, and there's much that I agree with the two that I have read. 3 minutes is not long, and I will not cover points of technical details that other speakers are covering. Instead, I'll make a couple of general points. In framing rules, we need to avoid being over-influenced by the circumstances that prevail today. they should also cater for circumstances that can arise in the future that we cannot presently envisage. We also need to consider the purpose of these rules. Are they to make sure that the firms are adequately capitalized for the types of risks that they have assumed, or should they also help them to take actions to mitigate those risks? I say this largely because with profits funds, long-term funds have come to a sorry pass over the last 15 years, largely because firms did not drop reversionary bonuses soon enough, and then not far enough, and because they did not address matching issues soon enough when yields were falling. It was known as early as 10 years ago, when bond yields first fell below 7%, that for most companies the scariest resilience test was the one involving a 3% fall in bond yields. Whilst this suggests that the culpability lies with the companies, had the resilience rules not been relaxed in the mid-90s, they might have forced these companies might have been forced to take painful action, which would have spared them greater pain that they have recently been through. For these reasons, I believe that the rules for prudential supervision need to be stringent. In a competitive market, commercial mistakes will be made, and in the extreme, companies will fail. The rules should not let such fundamentally weakened companies survive. In the days of Reddington, when our profession had clout and there was no valuation regulations, companies in this profession took steps to put the industry on the right collective course. Today, AOFT would have called that a cartel, but it was one that helped consumers in the end. In today's climate, the FSA has to play that role. And I think a key role here is to prevent the use of calibration approaches to market consistency that lead to different reserving requirements, as the industry will veer towards the one that produces the lowest provisions. I'd like to end by making a couple of points. First is that I strongly support the suggestion in the discussion paper, section 2.7, that a call option approach is preferable to the put option approach. Not only does it yield more useful information, it also more closely reflects the inherent nature of the bulk of the with-profits business. Were the with-profits business to go into runoff, which is a possibility, then such an approach will bring the two peaks closer together with the passage of time. My final comment is that it would be premature to permit the size of the provisions to be reduced by taking credit for future management actions. If this would lead to lower provisions, at least we should do that. It would be premature to do so without doing some back testing. Over the past 5 years, boards of most with-profits life companies have received financial condition reports where the outcome of various scenarios have been presented. I think it will be useful for the FSA to establish whether there's any evidence that many of them took appropriate action, appropriate heed of the messages. Thanks.
Mr. Vice President, ladies and gentlemen, I'm Seamus Creedon. During the last couple of years, I have, with colleagues in my firm and within our profession, carried out research on various aspects of risk management and supervision in insurance, with particular reference to the lessons which can be learned from banking sector developments. My comments are from that perspective and are entirely personal. I believe the proposals set out in consultative papers 190 and 195 reflect a considerable and welcome advance in supervisory philosophy and technique, and I've had the opportunity to congratulate individual actuaries who've been associated with the proposals. In the case of CP 195, however, my congratulations would be more fulsome if the proposals showed more commitment to a comprehensive Basel-style approach to risk and solvency management. The genius of Basel II is the three-pillar approach: minimum capital, supervisory review, and market disclosure. I can agree with commentators who argue that the Basel II process has overemphasized the first pillar at the expense of the second, although this was an inevitable risk in achieving international consensus across different supervisory philosophies. But the unbalanced emphasis is undoubtedly a factor in the lukewarm acceptance by Anglo-Saxon banks of Basel II. After a career divided between insurance and banking, I'm clear that insurance business and insurance risks are even more heterogeneous between firms and across geographies than is the case for banks. For this reason, I've always believed and recommended that Solvency II should include a primary emphasis on firms' self-assessment of the financial resources required, consistent with their appetite for risk, subject to penetrating supervisory dialogue. Pillar 1 should be kept reasonably simple and should serve mainly as a benchmark. This is the philosophy I looked for in the current proposals. Interestingly, I think I recognised it in CP 190, but I believe CP 195 can be improved. We're seeing some shift in the marketplace away from with-profit business towards other forms, especially individual and bulk annuity business. And this seems likely to continue, as does the growth of protection business. Failure to meet with-profit customers' expectations was at the root of our last crisis, but what do we imagine could cause the next one? In the same spirit, I believe the supervisor should be moving quickly to strengthen the incentives for management to invest in risk management. David Strachan recently expressed doubt about the industry's commitment to this. There will always be room for improvement in asset liability management, underwriting and claims management disciplines, rating approaches, unit pricing, operational risk mitigation, and more. These points have been underlined by the excellent work carried out within the IAA by Stuart Wason and his group on behalf of the International Association of Insurance Supervisors. That source work also shows that capital adequacy modelling must take account of both period and runoff horizons and can be independent of the basis of accounting for assets and liabilities. Briefly, the specific principles I'd like to see adopted are four. First, a primary emphasis on management's responsibility to sustain a coherent approach to measuring and explaining privately the adequacy of assets to meet liabilities in adverse conditions. And this can include rehearsing and committing to action to be taken in certain circumstances. For larger firms, this should be subject to mandatory demonstration by publication of a realistic balance sheet embracing all business. This would be a voluntary option for smaller firms. Most firms of any size already use proxies for realistic liabilities and are already rehearsing the implementation of changes in international financial reporting standards. Third would be definition of a realistic Pillar 1 requirement for financial resources in excess of realistic liabilities, again across all business. I think this could be done by recalibration of the parameters of the current solvency margin formula so as to achieve a broadly adequate minimum industry level of capital, analogous to the quantitative impact approach used under Basel. Pillar 1 should not be set so high as to stultify innovation in Pillar 2 modelling. We shouldn't dwell too much on spurious ruin probabilities, as others have said. Finally, we can retain a requirement, if we must, that all the foregoing be subject to a demonstration that the application of the minimum requirements of the EU directive would not give rise to a higher financial resource requirement. Several EU jurisdictions have had to evolve their supervisory approaches quite rapidly in recent years as economic conditions have changed. I was struck by John Tyner's recent enthusiastic comment to the Treasury Committee in answer to a question on the development of insurance supervision. In some respects, we can almost jump a generation from going from very old-style regulation to a much more modern basis, which banking hasn't even reached yet. I believe that's a reasonable ambition for what will be probably PS 195. We have the technology. Thank you.
Thank you, Seamus. Now, at this point, would any of our guests like to make a contribution? Paul.
Thank you. Paul Sharma from the Financial Services Authority. I'll start my remarks by thanking the Institute and thanking the authors for their papers. I can't say I've studied them all, but the first paper I studied at least in outline. I wanted to comment very briefly on some of the things that have already been said. Firstly, I wanted to give the clear message that the large majority of the things that have been raised here today are still open issues as far as the FSA is concerned. Some of those issues will get resolved by more detail and guidance in the FSA handbook. Some of them will get resolved, I hope, by faculty and institute guidance. And some of them will be left for the discretion of the actuaries concerned. I, for one, would never have the temerity to tell the actuarial profession what a risk-free rate is, and I would look to you to do that via your guidance, provided, of course, you came up with the answer that Andrew Smith suggested, which also reflects my own view. As regards the call and the put issue, as I think CP 195 tried to indicate by allowing room for a bonus reserve valuation, there is a genuine openness to alternatives to asset share-based methodologies. And indeed, the asset share-based methodology was not itself intended to indicate that the realistic liability could not fall below asset share. It clearly can. The smoothing adjustment can be negative. And to the extent to which the text does not make it clear, we can look at that again. But what I would say is, if one is going to use a method that is different from the asset share methodology, then one needs to be very, very clear about the basis upon which one is smoothing. And that needs to be clearly reflected in the PPFM, and it needs to be consistent with treating policyholders fairly. There is a lot of attraction to starting with guarantees and then adding something on, but there needs to be a lot of clarity about what is added on. The asset share methodology provides one method of providing that clarity, but by no means the only method. Next, very briefly, and I'll now try and rattle through my points, we are keeping very much an eye on what is happening in the accounting debate. The outcome we would like is that we base our requirements on a realistic balance sheet that is also very similar, if not identical, to where the IASB come out in their Phase 2 project. But we have necessarily gone in advance of that because we couldn't wait in terms of our regulatory reform that long. That leads me on to my next point. We are philosophically really quite committed to market consistency. I take the arguments to some extent about a runoff approach. I take the arguments to some extent about looking at temporary volatile prices. But I tend towards the view that inadequate and incomplete though it may be, the current market price is the one that gives you the most information about the future, and certainly more information than yesterday's or last week's or last year's market price, which is what you get on a historical cost accounting basis. Very briefly on the three pillars and the two peaks. A lot has been said about Basel three pillars and copying that. Just be a bit careful when people quote Basel three pillars, because they're not quite as they're sometimes popularly represented to be. I'll just mention one fact. Pillar one of Basel includes modelling. It includes VAR modelling for market risk. It's going to include operational risk modelling. Nobody quite knows how it's going to be done, but it's going to include it. And it includes something that is close to, even though not quite, credit risk modelling. That kind of individual bespoke assessment exists in Pillar 1 as well as in Pillar 2 in the Basel framework. In terms of the two peaks, here I wanted to address very briefly David Wilkie's contribution, a very erudite contribution, and I wasn't sure what I was going to say in response to it, but fortunately he ended with a question that I could actually answer, which is, why do we need two peaks? Why can't we just implement this, the realistic approach, as being consistent with the directive? The answer is very simple. The European directive does allow the provisioning of terminal bonus as part of the valuation. However, if we were to do this under the directive, that would have to be prudent provisioning of terminal bonus. And that is, in fact, what we originally proposed back in CP 97. So you would have a full liability guaranteed plus terminal bonus plus future bonuses done on a prudent basis, including implicit margins, together with the RMM on top. And I think a number of respondents to CP97 said that might not give a sensible answer. Very briefly, financial stability, a very important point, and also touches on an issue that I have to say we haven't fully bottomed, which is one that a number of you have raised. Individually, it may be logical and possible for particular companies to move to a matched position if they run into difficulty. The problem, however, with that is the sorts of circumstances that are likely to lead to companies running into difficulty can quite easily occur at the same time for everybody. And quite clearly, when that comes, it is neither possible nor desirable for everybody to move to a matched position. This is not a problem that's unique to insurance. I also work on liquidity for banking and various other banking subjects. It's a problem that arises there as well. Broadly speaking, we can't set capital requirements so that everybody in a general market crisis is capable of surviving regardless of whatever the government does in response to the general market crisis. The analysis with liquidity is, I think there is an assumption that the Bank of England will put some liquidity into the system in general rather than requiring every single bank to be able to survive a general liquidity crisis. Individual banks are required to be able to survive a liquidity crisis that is specific to them but not occurring in the market at large, and therefore does offer the possibility of hedging, but is not they're not expected to be able individually to be able to survive a general market crisis, because that would demand so much liquidity in the system as it would be a problem. I think I'll leave my comments there, as I'm sure I've more than gone beyond my 3 minutes. I'll just leave, depart by saying that I think the very last speaker sent a shudder down my spine when he said that John Tyner was talking about skipping a generation in insurance regulation.
Right, now we have just time for two more short contributions. There's a hand went up at the back earlier on. Is that person still keen to speak? No, doesn't look like it. Okay, in which case I'll ask Stephen Keane to make a contribution.
Good evening, Stephen Keane's my name. My contribution to the discussion would like to centre around the author's comments on the modelling of management decisions. We've seen it on the slide this evening, and section 5.3 set out three approaches. The first being a deterministic approach using closed form solutions, the second being stochastic simulation with little or no management decisions, and the third being stochastic simulation with dynamic management and policyholder actions incorporated. I was disappointed to read from the author's direct experience that few companies had developed such a model. That view is at odds with my own. I'm aware of a number of companies that not only have this capability in their models, but are fundamentally changing the manner in which they manage with-profits business as a consequence. This is the real carrot: to turn these models into useful management tools rather than systems that are built just to meet a regulatory burden. Looking at the issue from a perspective which places the stochastic dynamic model at the heart of the with-profits management framework is one where the cost-benefit analysis of investing in models of this nature more than adds up. In conclusion, I'd like to make the point that we're 1 month away from the fourth realistic reporting exercise. I could play devil's advocate and say realistic reporting is no longer a new issue. I probably would be devil's advocate if I did that. But in the author's own world, in the author's own words, the real power of stochastic simulation models is only realised if management and policyholder actions can be truly made dynamic. I say they can, and that if used properly, the management of with-profits funds will be all the better for it. Thank you.
Thank you very much. I think we'd better bring the discussion to an end there, and I will ask Mike Kipling, who's working hard for his free dinner today, to close the discussion.
Thank you, Vice President. Tonight's three papers together comprise some 140 pages. If we add to that the 46 pages of Martin Muir and Richard Waller's science paper earlier this month, we're still only just halfway to the length of CP195. And that is before we add in the additional 204 pages of CP202. Or was that 202 pages of CP204? In closing tonight's discussion, I would like to try to pull together some common themes from all three papers, as well as some comments from the floor. My first theme is the three-pillar approach to supervision. The International Actuarial Association paper to which Seamus Creedon referred endorses this approach, suggesting pillar one is derived from a fair value or market consistent base, plus a high 1 or 2 year survival confidence to allow realistic time for regulatory intervention. It also proposes that all major risks should be included at pillar one, but in a standard way. Pillar two should bring in other risks, such as strategic and liquidity risks, and should use advanced company-specific methods, which combine the different distributions of each individual risk exposure, allowing for correlations and dependencies. Seamus Creedon is a firm Basel fan, even if, as Paul Jarmer tells us, what we face is not quite Basel. The Canadian paper to which I think David Wilkie refers also envisages two tiers, reserves based on between a 60% conditional tail expectation and an 80% conditional tail expectation, and risk-based capital based on a 90% conditional tail expectation. The American Academy of Actuaries has recently adapted this work in the context of US variable products with guarantees. Comments from the floor include, or seem to me to indicate, some confusion over the need or the reason behind the Twin Peaks approach of Pillar 1. I think this is, as became clearer, more driven by the EU minima than by any particular desire to be seen to be meeting a test of guaranteed benefits. However, David Wilkie, who played a lead role in setting those minima, considered that it was probably unnecessary to make the test, given suitable modifications to the realistic basis. Iki Iqbal wisely reminds us not to react only to today's problems. And he also tells us that effective medicine is sometimes hard to swallow. Fundamental to these approaches is the stochastic model to be used in its calibration. Hare et al. Examined various economic models which use a variety of different calibrations and produce a wide range of results for guaranteed annuity options, and in particular, equity put options. Similar findings were reported by the Stochastic Accreditation Working Party and in Muir and Waller. Dalloway and Needleman, on the other hand, seemed to have untangled this apparent Gordian knot, at least in the Pillar 1 context, when they argued in Appendix A that because any model must reproduce the market price of options, the process is more akin to a mortality graduation with relatively little subjectivity. However, Andrew Smith challenged this apparent solution by showing that we would then have to value gilts at less than market value. Andrew also suggested an important principle that models should reflect what is important in the management of insurance companies. For Pillar 2, David Wilkie suggested that we could start by looking at the Canadian-US approach, which actually fits the regime-switching log-normal model to S&P 500 historic data and produces cumulative probability distributions of the value of £1 invested over different periods. Actuaries are not required to use this particular stochastic model, but any model that they do use must reproduce the tail characteristics of that distribution adequately well. Other comments from the floor. David Murray made the first call that the profession should, or that guidance should be issued. This was later echoed by others, including Andrew Smith, who said that it would avoid a descent into laxity or was that into laxatives? David Wilkie considered that stochastic models were more important in the calculation of capital margins than in the calculation of the basic reserves, although this too came under challenge from other speakers. My next theme is FSA's particular prescription for peak 2 of pillar 1, the realistic balance sheets. All the papers tonight support this approach in principle, but all have a lot to say about the detail. Dalloway and Needleman argue that the liability should be expressed as the value of the guarantee benefits, with only the excess of asset share being shown as available for future discretionary benefits. This has merit in focusing attention on the need to invest to match these guarantees, although this, I think, is something which would also become clear if Pillar 2 capital had to be held, for example, to a 90% conditional tail expectation level. Consistency of such an approach with asset share-related PRE might also be a concern, however. I wonder if the forthcoming consultation paper on treating customers fairly will shed any light on this aspect. The CP195 response and Dalloway and Needleman both highlight inconsistencies in the proposed treatment of non-profit business, and the former expresses the earnest wish that public presentation from next year should be realistic with a statutory underpin rather than vice versa as proposed. Again, something which was echoed from the floor. Hare et al. Provide in Chapter 6 a very helpful detailed comments on the individual items making up the realistic balance sheet, and of course the CP195 response also goes into this in some detail. Dalloway and Needleman in 4.4 make some interesting comments on the treatment of contingent loans, future shareholder transfers and subordinate debt. If we adopt a market-consistent approach as our mainstay, both FSA and the industry will need to examine whether these techniques should not also be applied to other valuation situations, including sub-debt and shareholder transfers. Colin Wilson urged that greater focus should be placed on Pillar 2 rather than on Pillar 1, and Richard Waller was unhappy about closed-form solutions, notwithstanding their advocacy by Andrew Smith. Turning to management actions, some interesting issues have been raised in the papers. Hare et al. Turned to hedging costs in 5.31, arguing that a possible Pillar 1 measure could be the market-consistent value of liabilities, which would equate to the cost of buying exact hedging assets today, plus a margin that would be sufficient to enable the firm still to purchase the hedge in an adverse scenario. As they point out, this is the theoretical basis of banks' 10-day value at risk measures. In 5.38, though, they carefully add, where there is no prospect of implementing a hedge, the resulting answers do not necessarily provide meaningful protection to customers. I would suggest that this will be quite a common situation, especially for large firms and or in respect of non-investment risks such as longevity. Consistency with PPFM is also required. If PPFM do not describe significant equity sales, irrespective of price, if certain triggers are breached, can such an approach fairly even be considered? Dalloway and Needleman actually model the effect of various management actions on the realistic balance sheet and cap risk capital margin. The results are very interesting, although it is notable that in the bonus reduction scenarios, the rate of bonus on conventional life business starts only at 1% per annum, and so is assumed to become zero in the risk capital margin stress. This highlights one important aspect of management actions. For continued credibility, firms will have to make the actions they commit to if the stress scenarios come about or their broad equivalents. Finally, I note that there were few comments on the profession's response to CP195. I would like to think this indicates acceptance rather than simply that no one has read it. If anyone does have any concerns about the response, please let us know quickly. In conclusion, I would like to express my personal thanks to all the people who have contributed to the papers before us tonight, and to our friends and colleagues at FSA who have worked so hard to get us as far as we have so quickly in CP195. With one more year of effort from us all, I believe we can have a solvency system that will truly reflect the risks being run by companies. And if we can't see how to do it yet, it's a relief to hear from Paul Sharma that it's not actually yet all completely decided, and to know that Seamus Creedon has the technology.
Thank you, Mike, and I'll now ask Peter Needleman to respond to the discussion.
Thank you. I think Mike has summarised the discussion, which I thought was really good, and I'd like to thank all the contributors. So I'm going to keep my comments really quite short, perhaps just a few thoughts, having heard the discussion. Clearly, there is going to be a lot of continuing debate about some of the technical details, and the profession, I hope, will arrive at some conclusions on some of these difficult issues fairly quickly. On the issue which a lot of speakers touched on, and I think there may have been some misinterpretation of our position around closed form solutions versus full stochastic modelling, we are not saying that closed form solutions are the answer and that's as far as you need to go. In fact, quite the contrary, although I think our position is probably closer to where David Wilkie is coming from. I think the real power, as a number of other speakers also said, of stochastic modelling is projecting the real world scenarios, looking at the types of actions that have to be taken in extreme events. And I think there's a world of insight that can be gained in managing with-profit fund and doing those projections. But we also come at it from a practical point of view. You cannot do stochastic projections within stochastic projections and management actions within stochastic projections to the second or third order. You have to take a fairly pragmatic approach to projecting the realistic balance sheet, because the reality is, in extreme scenarios, most management actions are driven by the what will be the realistic position, the realistic solvency position in the future. So within those projections, you do need to take a pragmatic approach to developing the projected realistic balance sheet. We are quite aware of how companies are developing in this area, and even in the time since we wrote the paper, companies are moving forward. But I'm not sure that many have yet, for example, full stochastic projections which project the full stochastic simulations which project the realistic balance sheet, for example, and given that that will affect management decisions in the future, I think that's fairly crucial. So we're trying to take a more pragmatic approach, because I think the faster we can move forward and companies can move forward on this, the more insights we'll gain. I think the discussion itself has highlighted there is still quite a long way to go. I think we're all putting a lot of time and effort into this, and we'll try and move things forward quite quickly. I'm encouraged that the FSA is still open-minded about the various presentational, if not more than that, approaches which could be adopted. And I think I heard quite a few speakers suggesting that some simplification of the balance sheet and greater focus on a single realistic peak, if at all possible, would be very helpful. I think that's really it, and I'm encouraged to thank you, all the contributors, to today's meeting, and we will, of course, respond in writing to some of the more detailed points. Thank you.
It's been an interesting last year for life actuaries. They've had to cope with learning the new techniques needed to produce realistic balance sheets, as well as dealing with all the other things that have been going on, including some very volatile equity markets earlier in the year. And I think collectively we've come a long way towards modernising the financial management of with-profits business in quite a short space of time, and that must be good for the profession. Some would say about time too, but at least we're going in the right direction fairly quickly. As Peter's just said, there's still a fair way to go, but there seems to be general agreement that proposals in CP195 represent a sensible way forward. For my taste, CP195 suffers a bit from TMA syndrome, that's too many acronyms, and it's perhaps a bit overcomplicated. But I do think it's important to keep a version of the statutory valuation that we understand until we're confident that realistic balance sheets are robust. There have been many suggestions for improvement of the CP195 proposals this evening, and I hope that some of those will be taken on board, but at this stage of the evening I'm not going to say which ones. It remains for me to express my own thanks, and I'm sure the thanks of all of us, to the authors of the various papers and documents, the opener, the closer, and all of those who participated in the evening's discussion. And I apologise to the one or two people who didn't get a chance to speak. It would also be very helpful for those preparing the transcript of the discussion for the British Actuarial Journal if you could hand any prepared notes to Maria Lyons, who's standing by the fireplace in the council chamber as you leave the meeting. The next sessional meeting of the Institute of Actuaries will take place at 5 o'clock on Monday the 26th of January 2004, when a discussion on pension schemes and fixed income investment is scheduled to take place. And finally, you are warmly invited to continue the discussion and join me for a glass of wine downstairs in the basement. There hasn't been room in the council chamber to set up the bar. I also have to say that with those attending the Gallio Club and other dining clubs, please ensure that they leave on time, which I think means about 7:15. I now declare the meeting closed.